This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
This is Too Long Should Read, the show that focuses on long reads around the internet worthy of your time. I'm Lee Chui Lin, and fittingly, today's episode is about the internet, or rather how teenagers use it.
The people who invented the internet had no idea that this would become the basis of society.
We've chased them out of the parks, we've chased them out of the malls, we've chased them out of our homes. And so they're falling back on these tools.
Big tits, tea, squirt.
I text them a lot, we tweet each other, and we talk on Google Talk a lot.
And have you had a boyfriend in real life?
No.
I change my status to awake, and then I have my shower. Come back and then change my status to getting ready. Then I might change it to songs that I'm listening to. Probably change it like 10 times on the way.
When you're young and you don't know any other way, you don't understand what some of these forces are, or you don't stop to ask.
The grown-ups gave our children...
That's usually the tone people take when discussing teenagers and social media. Some fear, some foreboding, a little bit of, what the heck are these crazy kids up to anyway? Today's article is different. It's titled, Like, Flirt, Ghost, A Journey into the Social Media Lives of Teens from Wired.com. And in it, Mary H.K. Choi takes a deep dive into the world of how teenagers use social media. She follows five. Twins, Lara and Sophia from Atherton, Ahmed from New Haven, Mira from San Francisco, and Ubakum from Houston. You'll be hearing their voices in this episode as well.
Lara and Sophia are shy, almost painfully so, with people they don't know. They move around in the world with heads close, chatting conspiratorially. This belies how substantial their Instagram reach is. Each 16-year-old has more than 1,000 followers, especially surprising when you realize that their feeds are locked, and the girls say they at least vaguely know every single person that follows them. Perhaps more impressive, though, each post on their feeds has at least 300 likes, meaning that roughly a third of their followers have signaled their approval. Just to give you an idea, only a fraction of Kim Kardashian's 78 million followers actually like her photos, about 2%.
My guest today, Nikki Cheung, writer, lecturer, and speaker on journalism and digital culture, as we navigate together the bewildering worlds of social media and Snapchat.
It's so difficult to learn. I mean, the other day I was talking to my niece and I was going like, how do you do that funny face thing? I'm pressing the screen, but nothing is happening. She's like, no, you got to hold it down for like 3 seconds. And I think Snapchat was built with this generation in mind, these people who are already very good with fiddling with these devices and figuring things out. It's not about buttons that are obvious to you. You have to do things which are unsaid and unwritten.
So here's the thing. Most of us of whatever age use some form of social media, but do we know the rules?
On Instagram, don't post photos of food. That is something that you can put on your Snapchat stories, but if it's something that no one really cares about, don't put it on your Instagram because people are just going to get annoyed with your account.
On social, I never post millions of selfies in one day because I know that bothers people.
Even on Snapchat, if you post many times a day, it's kind of annoying. Once a week, maybe. Once a day, just not like 10 times a day.
It's the thing I'd never post on social media is like, naked photo of myself.
One thing I would never do on social media is post a nude, whether it be my own or somebody else's. I think that's private.
Deleting comments is bad because they know that they didn't want that there. I've deleted comments. Yeah. I've deleted her comments. I've had friends that who text me later, text, which is formal, of like, why'd you delete my comment? And you kind of uncomfortable situation.
I asked Nikki how we know what the rules are and how things have changed.
The thing that's really interesting about social media is that even though it's only been, 10 years really, of Facebook and Twitter and stuff, these things have adjusted so much, right? It keeps constantly changing. I think we kind of have a feel of it. I think the article actually kind of made a reference to kind of how if you just ask them what are the rules, they can't really explain to you. But if you kind of go like, would you do this and would you do that? Then they can tell you, yeah, I won't do this and I won't do that. I mean, you talk about how you don't use it that way. But in 2007 and 2008, I think when we were all using Facebook, we all kind of knew what a poke meant, or throwing a pie in somebody's face, for example. I think those kind of things are actually very similar. It's just that they're obviously using it in a more nuanced way, and they have more access to different things, like not just Instagram, but Snapchat and even WhatsApp. And in Malaysia, we use WeChat and all that kind of stuff as well.
That multiplicity of apps also means that people have different behaviours and expectations on each of these platforms.
No, I do not use Facebook.
I know it as like a parent social media kind of thing. Like my grandma, my aunt are on Facebook.
That was like the first thing to come out, Facebook. So like after like Instagram and all that came out, we wanted to get the newer thing.
I use my phone for everything.
Instagram and Snapchat.
I either go on Snapchat or I'm on Instagram.
I do use Uber.
I'm on Snapchat and Instagram a lot. I'm using Instagram just to post pictures that I feel like pretty confident about.
I usually get above 100 likes.
I don't know, probably about 130. In the 200s.
Maybe like 74.
When a friend doesn't like my photo, I'm just like my photo.
You tell them to like it.
Yeah.
Nikki explains that having different behaviors in different spaces isn't all that different, technology or no technology.
No, it's just like how you and me, right? When I was growing up, because we didn't have this kind of technologies, we had to kind of make decisions. How would we behave in front of certain people, right? So when we were with our parents, we were a bit more less rowdy. When we were with friends, we would use languages that we might not normally use in front of a teacher. I think it's actually very similar. And that's the thing, because we always kind of think of technology and social media as this separate universe. But we also forget that we've also had kind of years to kind of build these kind of rules into our normal communication. So when do we whisper to someone? You know, who do we trust? So even when we build kind of networks of friendships, so who are our close friends who we can tell secrets to? Who are our acquaintances? Who are family and that kind of things? And I think the early days of Facebook really kind of alluded to that as well, because when they first introduced the list of how you can categorize your friends, they had acquaintance, special friends or something, they had family and things. They were already helping us do that. But I think over the last 5 or 10 years, as with a lot of things with social media, users themselves are kind of finding their own ways of creating these rules. I think a lot of kids in the article are right. There isn't one generic rule. You could see there was one video of the two sisters and they were kind of like, oh yeah, you wouldn't do this. I will only do this once a week. And then the other sister just went, oh no, once a day is fine. You know, so even within them, they don't actually agree on things. It's just kind of how they feel. It's very instinctive.
As Choi notes in the article, though, while most seem to know the rules, there are some who overstep.
On any platform, however, oversharing is considered taboo, or else awkward. Awkward is a ubiquitous teen word to denote socially unsanctioned behavior. It usually implies first or second-hand embarrassment when you or a friend step outside the rules. Awkward doesn't sound overtly judgmental or negative, it's deliberately vague.
Nikki weighs in.
The personalities that we portray on social media isn't always 100% representative of who we are, right? It's a representation, but it's not a whole. So what happens, I think, is that some people kind of overdo things. So maybe they might be very quiet in real life and they think that now that they've got this platform that they can be a bit more vocal and things. But then because they're doing that to compensate for something, they miss a lot of the kind of social cues of people who kind of get it. Some people are just better communicators than others. And again, this is common offline. Some people, they go to a party and they stand at the back and they observe. Some people like to be right in the middle of it. I think with social media, it's very similar, except that, of course, you have other elements kind of factoring in, like anonymity and all that kind of things that can change your behavior a little bit.
Choi also points out that since oversharing is just not done, aloofness has become a form of social currency, showing that you care with a like, but not that you care too much with a comment, for instance. I asked Nikki when this began to happen.
Yeah, I wonder whether it's from information overload. When I first started using Twitter, and this was in maybe 2008, 2009, there were not that many people there where even if I tweeted like 50 times a day, it was still manageable for people who were following me to read my tweets and to read tweets of other people. These days, there's so much and everybody's on Twitter and on Instagram and things that if you want to be noticed, then you can't be constantly posting because people can't keep up with everything. That might be where it comes from, just kind of going, okay, I post one thing so you know that it's important, as opposed to me posting 20 things and then you kind of go, oh God, it's another post from this person.
Fittingly here for a show about articles on the internet, Nikki references another article on the internet.
I was actually reading an article the other day, and they basically said that with Facebook, the less you post, the more your post gets read. I don't know how it works. Nobody understands the algorithms, obviously. But I think it makes sense in that way where if you're constantly posting things, people tend to react less to your posts. And if they react less, then Facebook thinks that less people are noticing it, and then they don't show it to other people.
There's also a level of focus here that I didn't expect to see from teenagers engaged in social media, mostly because it's not one that I myself apply to my social media life. This is how Ahmad, for example, handles his Instagram.
Ahmad, who has 965 followers and 16 posts, scrupulously edits his feed just like Laura and Sophia do. If I'm not touching 40 likes, I'm probably going to delete it, he says. The window to reach 40 is about 2 hours. Sometimes he'll delete a post, save it, and put it up at a better time.
That seemed like a lot of effort for success that seems kind of vague at best, at least to me.
I think everybody knows what a success is. I think it's recognition. The internet is a horrible place. You don't want to suddenly wake up to tweets, people talking about you and talking behind your back. There's this thing that we used to use on Twitter about 4 or 5 years ago called unmentions, where people are talking about you without tagging you onto your tweets. You don't want to get caught in that kind of conversations. So you do certain things to make yourself look like, you know, you're more successful than you probably are. Because, I mean, this success might not pay the bills and win you awards and stuff, but, you know, it's social currency, right? So if you're generally popular in your own community, then people just respect you a little bit more. They treat you better. There was that 15-year-old girl, I think, who talked about how she was very quiet in school and she doesn't have a lot of friends and stuff. And I think that kind of things can help you. You know, if people like the kind of things that you post, suddenly your status kind of elevates, or there's people see you from a different light. Because in person, you might just look like this dreary, boring person. But if you take good photographs, for example, then people go, oh, you know, at least she's good at something, or that kind of stuff. So I think that there is a bit of that.
While I might not relate 100% to how teenagers use social media, there's little denying that there are some areas in life where, no matter how much things change, the fundamentals just will not budge. More on that up next on Too Long Should Read, BFM 89.9.
Tinder, changing the way we date. Uber, changing the way we get from place to place. We've combined both. Say hello to Oonder, the car service for people looking to meet that special someone on the way to wherever. Step one, open the Oonder app and activate. If you don't like the way the driver looks, simply swipe left using Oonder's ultra-convenient technology.
Hey guys, it's Megan. Welcome to my channel. If you're just stumbling upon it, and you probably are just stumbling upon it because we're talking about Tinder, and apparently that's a really popular thing with the hip young crowd, which I'm young, but oh child, am I not hip. I will be the first to admit that I have had a Tinder account. I have Tindered with the best of them. I have swiped left, I have swiped right, I have messaged, I have responded, I have done all of the things that you do on Tinder, aside from actually meeting anybody in person, because that just freaks me out.
This is Too Long Should Read. I'm Lee Chui Lin. Our long article today focuses on the lives of teenagers and how they use their social media. It's called Like, Flirt, Ghost, A Journey into the Social Media Lives of Teens. It's up on Wired.com. It's written by Mary H.K. Choi. It's very good. Go read it. My guest today, Nikki Cheung. So much as we might like to imagine that the world we occupy today is entirely dissimilar to the one that our parents occupied when they were young, we all know that isn't true. And Mary Choi starts to point that out in the article as well, all the things that are more similar than they are different.
For teens, texts and snaps and video calls are real life, the equivalent of walking around in the mall for hours in the olden times, trying to catch the eye of a hottie in the food court. As much as technology has changed the way we talk, think and do things, some key teen problems are as they've always been.
This, of course, is really not that new. Just as an example, this movie came out in 1998.
I turn on my computer. I go online.
Welcome.
And my breath catches in my chest until I hear three little words.
You got mail.
What is going on with you?
Is it infidelity if you're involved with someone on email?
This woman is the most adorable creature I've ever been in contact with.
Have you had sex?
Of course not. I don't even know her.
I mean cyber sex.
No.
Well, you know what? Don't do it. Because the minute you do, they lose all respect for you.
In a city where everyone's looking for someone, Joe and Kathleen have discovered the best way to meet someone.
Hi.
Is to never meet at all.
You just email. It's really nothing. I don't know.
And even Nikki said that he identified with this bit as well.
But then when they start talking about flirting and things, I just realized that, hey, you know, I used to find ways to kind of flirt with people and give social signals that I was trying to be subtle about. When they're talking about deleting of comments or blocking people, for example, we used to do that with IRC, you know, like, and we used to gang up on people, not let people into certain chat rooms. They talk about fake accounts. We used to kind of create a different username to kind of see whether this person likes us, and we go in there and talk, oh, do you know this person? What do you think of him or her? And that kind of stuff. We used to do all these things. It's not actually very new behavior. It's just done in a very, very different way. And in a way which we will kind of object to at the moment, because someone like me, for example, I will never delete comments because I just think that it's so important for record and history, and that's not how social media should be used. But obviously, these young people don't have the same kind of reasoning as I do.
Just like the general rules of what it means to be on social media, the teens interviewed in the piece had some pretty clear views on what flirting should be like.
I have definitely followed a crush on Instagram. That's a one way of hitting on someone now. I watch my friend do it all the time. He's like, follows them, DMs them.
Leave like some heart eyes or heart or kissy emoji.
I think I'd put sparkles everywhere.
Or you could blow her feed up with likes.
It works. Oh yeah, he definitely like succeeds.
I'd follow that person off a different account because I don't want them to know that it was me requesting them.
If you have a crush, I think you should Snapchat them. It could be funny, and they get a little more insight into your personality. I think if you Snapchat them like consecutively over many days, and you guys like formulate a Snapchat streak, it's like mutual interest.
Goes through, she's coming back, maybe some hard eyes or whatever. Boom, got in the bag.
And that speaks to how real life and online life can blur in the realm of love and relationships, and how that in turn bleeds over into everything else.
I feel like I've forgotten that line already because, I mean, over the last 10 years, you know, with online dating and all that kind of stuff, I think flirting and dating has changed so much in general anyway, even before liking someone's Instagram or following someone on Snapchat and hoping they follow you back as a signal. You know, the days of people meeting in clubs and stuff are not as popular as they are today when you can just swipe a photo of this cute girl or a cute guy. I think the blurring has happened for quite a while. We've seen this happen. But I think, you know, at the end of the day, it still comes back to real life. You can flirt as much as you want online, but if you're going to go on a date, you have to go and date in person. I feel like my generation grew up more with this whole cyber dating thing than people do now, because I think it's so easy these days with location to find people. Whereas back then, I myself were, you know, like in cyber relationships, relationships with people I've never met and I probably will never meet. Some of whom I've forgotten about. But we used to speak so much on a daily basis on chat rooms and that kind of things. I think these days, the blurring is more because social media has really transcended digital and it's actually become part of our lives. And, you know, I mean, with flirting specifically, I think online dating has totally changed things tremendously.
Another area in which life online mirrors that of life in the quote-unquote real world is that teenagers will always be embarrassed by their parents. That's just the way things go.
I got my dad on Snapchat, but I never contact him. I had posted something on my story, and he saw it, and then he commented on it, and like he sent me a direct message, and I just like blocked him after that.
My parents don't follow me, but I follow my parents. Same.
My family members don't need to see what I be doing. They don't.
Choi writes that when it comes to family, embarrassing though they might be, they play a crucial function.
It's hardly revelatory, but it's important to remember that teens are changing all the time. When you talk about them in groups, you'll do it wrong. If you ask them to tell you about themselves, you'll do it wrong. The only thing you can do is interact with them and draw loose conclusions based on their behavior. But if there's one thing about teens that shouldn't be ignored, it's that their ability to use technology safely while taking advantage of all its benefits depends largely on their relationships with their parents.
Nikki agrees, but also points out how teenagers interact with their parents on social media is actually as traditional as can be if you remove the trappings of technology.
I think it's important. That's why they block them out. And that's the thing. That's why I think that these young people are much more clever than we give them credit for, because they know that what they're doing is no different from what their parents used to do. It's just that their parents never had social media to kind of blast it out on, right? Because if not, then they won't come out and say things like, I'm blocking my parents. Because the moment you block your parents, you're trying to hide something from them. So I think they acknowledge still the traditional structures of a family and that kind of things. I think what's fascinating towards the end as well is them talking about how they blocked it. Like, I think there was a video in the article that one of them said that the moment my father left me a message, I blocked him on Snapchat. And I actually wonder whether this is the reason why young people have moved away from Facebook and Twitter and started using more chat apps than anything else, because their parents can't be there. I remember when Facebook just started, a lot of parents told their children, we'll let you open an account on the condition that you let us into your Facebook. You have to accept us as a friend. That's a precondition, right? The same thing with Twitter as well. If you're going to have a locked account, we have to be in there. But then we start using things like WhatsApp, and then, of course, then the WeChat and the Line, and then now with Snapchat. These are things that there's no actual kind of timeline for your parents to check up on you. It's individual stuff. So you can be very much more personal and keep them out. And I wonder whether this is actually the reason why this social media has moved into this direction. It's because young people are not actually, as we think about themselves, being less private about their lives, but they are trying to be more private about their lives.
And if anything, that seems to show that even as teenagers try to create more privacy and boundaries, they do allow their parents in to a certain extent, and it's all not that bad after all.
What's very interesting as well, and it's something that's come up in the article and something that I've kind of thought about before, is that I think that young people are actually more willing to engage with the older people than we think they are, because a lot of them will accept their parents in. They just don't want their parents to engage with them because it's so uncool, right? It's something that's been happening for generations, the whole uncool parent. But they're happy for their parents to be seeing their stories and that kind of things, you know. It's only when the parents overstep these boundaries. So I think what's basically going to happen is that we'll have a generation of parents who actually understand these things. They might not understand how it's being used at the moment, but they understand the idea of digital and privacy and all that kind of things. And it'd be much easier for them to give their young people the kind of support that they will need to be able to move forward in the world.
Finally, Nikki addresses this idea of why teenagers are our future tellers, our sages.
You know, teenagers, it's a time when they're old enough to understand the world, but naive enough to believe in dreams and hopes and possibilities. They're the ones who are willing to experiment, less baggage. So these are all the kind of things that I feel allows them to dictate what comes next. And that's exactly what happened with social media, right? All these apps and things that we were using were all, you know, Facebook was created in college. Computers were created in garages and stuff. It's every generation has that kind of thing. And it takes that kind of idealism and willingness to kind of put hard work without having to worry about paying bills and that kind of stuff that allows you to shape things to come.
My guest this week, Nikki Cheong, writer, lecturer and speaker on journalism and digital culture. We've been discussing Mary H.K. Choi's article on Wired.com, Like Flirt Ghost, A Journey into the Social Media Lives of Teens. And now for our word of the week, tacit. Used here. Then there is the rule about likes and comments. According to Lara and Sophia, when your friend posts a selfie on Instagram, there's a tacit social obligation to like it. And depending on how close you are, you may need to comment. Tacit means understood or implied without being stated or openly expressed. Or you could be describing a person who's saying nothing, who's very quiet. Basically, it describes things that go unvoiced or unspoken. Because so much of our show has been about what is implied, what isn't explicitly said, tacit seems to be a good word to end the episode on. And that is it from me this week. For more episodes of Too Long Should Read, check out bfm.my/too long. Thank you very much for listening. This has been Too Long Should Read on BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.